From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us, followed, of course, by Conversations with Linda. Here's what's happening. Scientists are warning that the West Antarctic ice sheet could collapse, potentially causing sea levels to rise, get this, more than 49 feet by 2500. That's the year. The study published in the journal Nature this week cites the impact, they say, of greenhouse gas emissions over the coming decades. Collapsing Antarctic ice could cause sea levels to rise more than 3 feet by 2100. That would wipe out all the coastlines. Skeptics, however, have largely dismissed fears over man's impact on global warming, saying climate change has been going on since the beginning of time. They also claim the dangers of a warming planet are being wildly exaggerated, and the question of the impact that fossil fuels have had on climate change is negligible. The State Department has been forced to apologize after a bizarre tweet that appeared to offer overseas travel advice specifically for ugly Americans. For the past several days, the Bureau's Twitter account has posted strange messages offering practical, straightforward travel advice for American students heading overseas, such as, if you're not a 10 in the U.S., then you're not a 10 overseas. Beware of being lured into buying expensive drinks or worse, being robbed. If you are a 2 in the United States, be sure to budget enough money to pay for your own drinks abroad, you loathsome harridan. It makes no sense. It's weird. They've apologized. Faced with a North Korean regime bent on developing a nuclear-armed long-range missile, President Obama met in Washington with several world leaders, including those of China, Japan, and South Korea, in an effort to hammer out some kind of united response. In a Washington Post opinion piece, the president called for the international community to remain unified in the face of North Korea's continued provocations. North Korea launched a short-range projectile, the latest in a series of short-range missile launches and artillery system tests from its dictatorship. Dr. Jerome Corsi, of course, who writes for WND. You know, the rhetoric from North Korea, Jerry, is getting worse, I think.
Well, they're certainly getting more provocative with missile launches, George. I mean, it's almost constant that North Korea is launching a missile, and in a provocative way. This summit that's going on right now in Washington is well-intentioned, but, you know, it's difficult to think any progress is going to come of it. China's participating. China's going to develop this 14,500-kilometer range DF-41, which is a multiple warhead weapon that can hit anywhere in the United States from China, from anywhere in China. I mean, also China's participating in this summit trying to restrain North Korea when China itself is developing a whole new range of ballistic nuclear weapons.
Jerry, do you think there's going to be a preemptive strike against North Korea? I mean, if your neighbor kept saying, Corsi, I'm going to shoot you, I'm going to shoot you, I mean, how long would you put up with that?
Well, you know, George, it's been going on for a long time, and I think it's always a potential. And the only way to really restrain North Korea is with China, because North Korea is so dependent on China economically. North Korea is a desperately poor country. People suffer tremendously. And yet the regimes have always had this aggressive nuclear policy. At some point or other, I think it's always a threat that South Korea or one of the other countries, including the United States, is going to say enough is enough. But, you know, George, I'm worried also about nuclear proliferation in the Middle East.
Yes.
And I worry that we're on the edge of, you know, within the next 20 to 50 years, having a nuclear war break out either in Asia or in the Middle East.
Well,
it's increasingly likely.
We can't let ISIS get a hold of nukes.
It's a frightening thought, you know, George, but with Pakistan having nuclear weapons and with Iran developing likely to have nuclear weapons, I don't think the treaty we just signed is going to restrain. Certainly Iran is more and more firing off missiles, And I would think Saudi Arabia and some of the other countries are going to look at to have nuclear arms themselves. I think we're entering a very dangerous phase of provocative countries developing nuclear weapons and proliferation occurring. It's very frightening right now to see the nuclear scene, and these conferences we're having in Washington around the world do not seem to be producing any meaningful nuclear disarmament agreements.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Dr. Jerry Corsi. A Korean man has been arrested after doing yoga and meditating on an airplane. A Japanese-bound airplane returned to Hawaii because of a violent passenger who wanted to do yoga instead of sit in his seat. The pilot of the March 26 United Airlines flight from Honolulu to Japan turned the plane around after hearing the yelling at crew members, and the guy was shoving his wife. He told the FBI he didn't want to sit in his seat during the meal service, so he went to the back of the plane to do yoga and meditate. He became angry when flight attendants and his wife told him to return to his seat. A number of Americans filing for unemployment benefits rose last week. That was unexpected, but a sharp drop in layoffs in March suggesting the labor market's momentum remained intact. But let's check in with Michael Mish Shedlock on this one, a registered investment advisor. I still think they're playing with these figures, Mish.
Absolutely, George. States play with the figures. They come out late. But the key here is employment is a lagging indicator. And you know, and I know, that all of these part-time jobs people are taking, multiple type part-time jobs, are adding to the picture. But if I can comment on something that Jerry said, because this is what was on my plate today, who was just on warning about nuclear attacks. On my screen right now, the U.S. Justice Department came out and is warning of lethal cyber jihadi attacks on our infrastructure.
That's right.
The former defense secretary came out today and said the U.S. is on the precipice of a nuclear arms race. Obama wants to spend $1 trillion on small, flexible nukes. Today, listen to this, Japan dumped its anti-war constitution and is going to allow attacks. Isn't the conversation everywhere you look getting increasingly darker and darker and darker? George, it's scary.
It sure is, Mish. But let's keep watching these figures and see what happens in the future. Let's hope things get better. In Denver, people are being creeped out. For months, small baby doll faces have been popping up all over Denver. They're on curbs, they're on medians, they're on buildings. Many of them have been photographed, yet many often go unlooked. People have no idea what they are, what they mean. Just strange baby faces popping up all over Denver. You know, some time ago we talked about an incredible story that affects so many women, and we're going to do that again tonight. A tragic outcome happens in one in 350 women who undergo a procedure that is very dangerous. We're going to talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Dory with you. You know, every once in a while, we have to take a step back and cover a story that affects so many people, and it's not getting reported on, and it continues. We're going to be talking about a device called the Morcellator. Now, you might not even know what it is. We're going to tell you about that. But for more than 20 years, it's been causing harm to women without the FDA or the public even knowing about it. And if they do, they surely aren't telling anybody about it. We've got two guests back on Coast to Coast. First of all, Dr. Hooman Noorchasam back with us, of course. He is a very specialist doctor. He is a surgeon in the Philadelphia area, trained at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and Harvard's Medical School's Brigham Young and Women's Hospital as well. Both hold PhDs in immunology. I'll bring his wife in a moment, but let me say hi to Dr. Hooman, if I can. Welcome back, doctor.
Thank you, George. How are you?
Good, good. I'm looking forward to this. And his wife, of course, Amy Reed, in addition to being MDs, also holds a PhD in immunology. And she went through a procedure that I'll have her tell you about that has spearheaded what we're talking about tonight. But Amy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, George.
Amy and Doctor, let's first start. Doctor, let me start with you first of all. Tell me how you got involved with this with Amy. Was it because of her personal situation?
Yeah, George. So basically, this all started for us in October of 2013 after my wife had an operation that was supposed to be a routine operation for a benign condition. And essentially, it turned out that she had had an occult cancer, a so-called hidden cancer called a leiomyosarcoma, which is a relatively aggressive cancer. And, you know, this was not diagnosed, it was not picked up on, and, you know, the clinicians, the surgeons essentially would go ahead and proceed with using this power device called the power morcellator. And, you know, the device basically spreads both cancerous as well as non-cancerous tissues inside the abdominal cavity of women in the process of taking these fibroid tumors out. So that's what happened to my wife, and then I pretty much immediately after I heard about it, I recognized it as a pretty big mistake in gynecological surgery. And so we initiated a campaign in October of 2013.
Now I know, and you both haven't stopped. Are you? Is it starting to get some support?
Well, you know, we've had a tremendous amount of progress in the past 2.5 years. For starters, the FDA put a black box on this, and then essentially they released a statement called an immediately in effect statement, which is probably one of the most aggressive, you know, statements that the FDA could make. Essentially, you know, saying that this procedure should not be used in the vast majority of women. Johnson & Johnson, which was the largest producer of this device, also took the device off the market, and a pretty substantial number of insurance companies are refusing to, at this point, fund this procedure, and many of them are actually requiring pre-authorization if the physician insists on using it. So I think we've met with some good success. Now, there are still physicians who are insisting. You know, there are a lot of professional egos and a lot of you know, infrastructure invested in this practice, and certainly there's a company by the name of Karl Storz, which is operates out of Germany with an American subsidiary that has refused to take the product off the market, despite the fact that Johnson & Johnson did. So, you know, we're up against some, you know, real bad guys, I would say.
And Dr. Reed, Amy, let's bring you in here for a moment. This situation for you, it started as just a routine procedure, didn't it?
It did. You know, I was diagnosed with fibroids, which estimates say up to as many as 8 out of 10 women had. But the difference was I had symptoms. I went to my doctor complaining, and they said, oh, this is how fibroids behave. You have nothing to worry about. And I had every test you can imagine. I had biopsies, I had ultrasounds, I had MRIs. And everyone reassured me that this was completely normal and, you know, common. A lot of people have it. Don't worry about it. You'll have surgery. You'll get back up on your feet. And that couldn't have been further from the truth.
Now, when this happened, of course, and it is a tragic outcome happens, the statistics we talked about on your last appearance, 1 in 350 women, that's pretty darn high. Even if it doesn't sound like it is, that's high, isn't it, Amy?
That's extraordinarily high. You know, in medicine all the time we talk about, you know, what is the numbers of, you know, this, that, the other thing. And 1 in 350 is very high for something like this. I mean, you're talking about spreading cancer, via a device that's enormously high.
The device cuts up tissue into little, I guess, pieces, and is that what contributes to spreading the cancer?
Yeah, exactly. The cancer, I mean, with any cancer, you know, there's always the concern for spreading it. And in this type of cancer, particularly a sarcoma, is that you want to get it out in one piece because it very easily grows in other places. So if you spill it, it will, you know, the potential for it to grow is very high. And so this device, which basically just chops things up into like a, and it's almost like a meat grinder, it chops it up into little pieces that they then suck out. But I mean, there's lots left behind, pieces, drippings. I mean, it's really very graphic when you watch the video. And in this type of cancer, I mean, I can't think of a better way to spread it.
Dr. Norchesman, what is taking the FDA so long to say something or do something about this?
Well, so there are a couple of issues here to consider. Number one is, you know, the FDA in the medical device sector, you know, operates within a regulatory framework that is essentially not safety-based. You know, the main focus of the FDA's regulatory paradigm with respect to medical devices has to do with getting, quote-unquote, life-saving devices onto the market efficiently. That's not the same thing as patient safety. That's not the same thing as ensuring patient safety. So the vast majority of medical devices in this country are not going through any sort of safety testing. Essentially what happens is they end up on the market and they rely either on, you know, post-market surveillance mechanisms, or they rely on reporting, self-reporting by physicians and hospitals. So essentially what that amounts up to is that the population is essentially used as guinea pigs for these medical devices that enter the market. Now, you know, we're very fortunate. We live in the United States, and the vast majority of physicians and engineers, you know, are safety oriented. But, you know, even if a small minority of devices end up being harmful, the reality is that the FDA doesn't really have any, you know, solid checkpoints, safety checkpoints. And with respect to the power morcellator itself, the failure has been a failure in reporting. So in other words, the manufacturers and the physicians and hospitals involved with the use of this for about 20 years have been very well aware of the fact that in certain women who have occult or missed cancers, the cancer is upstaged. So in other words, you go from a stage one cancer to a man-made stage four cancer.
Oh, God.
Which essentially is, you know, is a horrific outcome from any perspective. So you know, the problem here is with respect to the medical device, it's sort of a problem with the broader regulatory paradigm that the FDA uses with respect to medical devices. And the fact here is that this is a failure in self-reporting of this complication for 20 years. So literally, I mean, if you do the math, you know, probably on the order of thousands of women in the United States alone have been harmed. And if you integrate it worldwide, it's even a larger number.
I keep thinking of that mesh, that surgical mesh that is being recalled, or there are a number of lawsuits related to that as well. Again, was this another you know, piece of equipment, an apparatus, a tool that the FDA just simply did nothing about?
Yeah, George, that's exactly right. I mean, there are a couple of pretty egregious examples. This piece of regulation is called 510K. And again, it regulates the vast majority of medical devices that come into contact with patients' bodies. The pelvic mesh is another one of the mesh that you're mentioning is another example of a 510K approved device. So you know, there are a large number of devices out there that basically go through this mechanism, and you know, again, they're not safety tested. They don't go through any sort of clinical trials formally like drugs do. And then so they enter the market, and if they start harming people, the only mechanism that would stop them from harming people is if hospitals and manufacturers report back. Now, if they don't report back, problems keep going on. And the other example of it is these duodenoscopes. You know, these scopes that they're using, the Olympus scopes that were basically cross-contaminating patients based on the GI bacteria. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Yeah, we sure have.
So these are all falling under the same category. There are multiple examples of this, but I think the power morcellator in particular is, you know, is a pretty powerful example of this, because number one, it's cancer. Number two, it takes patients from early stage cancers to advanced stage cancers, and number three, it's a women's health problem, which I think, you know, on all three counts, you know, we got to sort of step back and ask ourselves, well, why in God's heck is this going on? And why is it that the FDA is not picking up on it? And why is it that after we brought it to the attention of folks, did the gynecological industry resist us? I mean, you know, even up to this day, what we're getting is a lot of resistance and a lot of pushback from gynecologists who basically want to insist that this is actually a matter of risk management. So in other words, you know, because the majority benefit, the majority of patients benefit from, you know, having this morcellator used, you know, it's justified to expose a minority subset of people to a mortality hazard.
All right, hold on, doctors. We'll be back with more, and we'll take some calls on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe, joins us, but we're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls and continue chatting with the two doctors about the incredible morcellator device, which apparently is very dangerous to women. So take heed on that. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Drs. Amy Reed and Dr. Hooman Norchasm as we talk about the morcellator device, which has been causing harm to women for a long, long time. Dr. Norchasm, how expensive is the procedure using this device?
Well, George, you know, the morcellator device itself is not terribly expensive. I mean, it's somewhere about $1,000 to $3,000 in terms of the cost of the device itself. But then each one of these procedures reimburses the hospital from insurance companies on the order of about $30,000.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a relatively, you know, well-reimbursed procedure. It's certainly a very common procedure. So, you know, somewhere around 60 to 70% of women by the age of 70 in the United States end up having a hysterectomy or a myomectomy. So, it, you know, it's a very rich revenue stream for gynecologists. And, you know, so basically a lot of gynecologists have been relying on this technology to mince up, you know, enlarged uterine fibroids and getting them out with relative ease. What they were ignoring was the fact that, you know, a subset of these women will have cancer. A subset of these fibroid tumors will actually not be benign and they will be cancerous. You know, that assumption was a deadly assumption for the subset of people who did have these cancers. And so that's basically what was, I think, you know, suppressed to a certain extent. I mean, there were institutions that had this knowledge. Certainly the Brigham and Women's Hospital, where my wife's operation happened and where I was a surgeon at the time myself, had this information as early as 2009, but in violation of federal law and in violation of medical ethical principles, they had not informed the FDA. So the entire leadership hierarchy at that hospital was aware of this complication. Certainly a very prominent individual prior to Amy's complication had a complication at that hospital, but they hadn't bothered to report this back to the manufacturer or to the FDA, and that's federal law. So they are, frankly, in violation of federal law, not to mention the sound principles of medical ethics. So, and this is all basically because these folks were punch drunk on the revenue stream that this thing is generating for them.
Have there been any litigation cases, any settlements, anything going on there?
Yeah, so just recently, actually, Johnson & Johnson settled with somewhere around 50 or 70 plaintiffs. And unfortunately, you know, from our perspective, this is really a shame, because I think these plaintiffs' lawyers basically haven't even had to fire a single shot, and they're walking away with millions of dollars because, you know, our campaign basically succeeded in getting this thing banned, and Johnson & Johnson did what they did in withdrawing the device off the market. So these plaintiffs' lawyers are essentially failing to even make a public record, because each one of these settlements comes with a gag order, you know?
Uh-huh.
And when you put a gag order, that means that nobody will find out what happened, exactly how this happened, why it happened, when it happened. And so, you know, every one of these cases is an opportunity to create a public record so mm-hmm. something like this doesn't happen again in this country.
Okay, I want to go to Amy. She was coughing. Is she all right?
Yeah, she's all right.
No, that's actually one of the kids.
Oh, the kids are coughing. Okay. In this particular case, Amy, at what point do they use the device? I mean, what's the catalyst to say, we need to use this?
So, you know, it's been difficult to really get a grasp on it, and I think a lot of people have kind of shut down in terms of discussing whether or not they're using this. We know that, you know, most of our colleagues that we talk to tell us that whereas it went from being used in probably the majority of the cases, now it's much more rare, and people have to, you know, physicians have to make an argument, you know, at the level of the hospital, why they should use it. So in that regard, I think we've made some headway instead of it being kind of just the default tool being put mm-hmm. in everyone's hands. People are actually thinking about whether or not they should be using it. Of course, I mean, it's a far cry from where we think it should be, which is not used at all and on the shelf. But, you know, at least I think it, the discussion's been opened, you know, particularly the FDA's wording, you know, that says it probably should not be used in the majority of women. Most people have taken heed of that, but that still leaves the possibility that some people could potentially benefit even. And I think that really is a disservice.
Was it a useful device? Is it a useful device on non-cancerous tissues?
So, no. You know, the issue at hand here is, you know, the gynecological surgeons, so OBGYNs who do these surgeries, they say, we need this tool to do laparoscopic, minimally invasive surgery. So in order to do surgery through small incisions, we need this tool. No other field in medicine uses this tool. No other field of surgery uses this tool because it's a bad tool, because it can spread cancer, because you shouldn't cut things up, even that aren't cancer. So to answer your question directly, even if you don't have cancer and you cut up healthy tissue, that can lead to scar tissue. It can lead to growth of healthy tissue that causes, you know, everything from chronic pain to bowel obstructions. So, no, there is never a time when you need to use this tool. Other fields of surgery do plenty of minimally invasive surgery without using it. And for a variety of reasons, this tool has landed firmly in the hands of gynecological surgeons and has been that way for about 20 years now. And because of, you know, sort of the training platform and the feedback they get from other specialties, or rather lack thereof, you know, they didn't think it was a problem.
And they really
didn't get feedback.
Dr. Nordstrom, I love modern medicine and technology. I think that the technological advances have been incredible. I've got a friend who's going in for knee surgery. They're going to poke three little holes in his knee. In the old days, they would have slit him right across. As a surgeon, have you seen some great advances here with technology?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's no question that, you know, I think technology is and innovation is rests at the core of, you know, being able to save lives and improve the health of our country. There are very prominent examples of medical devices that come to mind, such as heart valves. I mean, you know, the advent of heart valves, you know, I mean, it saved thousands upon thousands of people when we can go in and replace people's aortic valves or mitral valves. But all of this has to come within the context of risk management and safety. And in other words,
right,
any of these medical devices or technologies are imposing an avoidable mortality risk, especially. We're not talking about a trade-off between, you know, you buy one, you buy one risk hopefully find a cure to a disease that you have. What we're talking about here is an avoidable mortality risk in upstaging cancer. So in this particular instance, you know, this doesn't fall into the category of, you know, a life-saving device such as a heart valve or, mm-hmm. or you know, we are very frequently are using these minimally invasive operations to replace the heart valve in elderly patients who can't have open heart surgery. These are incredible strides in technology. But when we're talking about the morcellator is a device that's only used by gynecologists to mince up tumors inside someone's body. Now, from a surgical perspective, every other branch of surgery considers this to be a mistake. The reason why gynecologists had adopted it is because they sort of operate in this silo away from everybody else. They don't cross-train with other surgeons. So in other words, you know, when I confronted this and my wife, after 9 years of training at two of the top institutions in this country, you know, I'd never heard of a power morcellator.
Right. That's
the degree of sort of isolation that the gynecologists have from the rest of the surgeons. So that's a defect in the training process that ultimately has led to this practice being sort of a standard of care in gynecology, but nowhere else. So it's really an error in judgment, frankly. You mm-hmm. know, and in surgical practice.
And I would guess that a lot of the gynecologists who initially used the piece of equipment probably thought they were doing something very worthwhile with it, right?
Well, you know, George, the vast majority of them still do, and I think this comes to the core of the argument here, right? And I think I tried to touch on this on our previous show. The argument that's being used here is that because the vast majority of women benefit, okay, from this practice, and what's the benefit? The benefit is they can do small incision surgery and they can discharge women home the same day. So the profit margin for the hospital and the doctor is better. And the women have smaller incisions, so it's a little bit more cosmetic.
Yes.
So essentially what they're saying is, look, you know, the majority of women are benefiting because the majority of women don't have cancer, and that's true. But what the cost of that is to this minority subset of women, this 1 in 350, right, who actually have cancers that can't be diagnosed, okay? I mean, the key is this, is that if you can't diagnose cancer with certainty in a mass, then you should take universal precautions, you know? I mean, that's what we do as doctors for ourselves, right? I mean, if I always mask up, I have a glove and a gown on because there's a 1 in 2,000 chance that I might contract HIV. So I protect myself from that kind of risk. Why aren't we protecting patients from a 1 in 300 to 1 in 500 risk of cancer? I mean, it's sort of a backwards way of approaching patient care. So
poor little baby's coughing away like crazy, huh?
Yes.
Let's go to the phones.
I want to mute it there.
Let's go to Noel in Everett, Washington. First time caller. Hi, Noel. Go ahead.
Hi there. Back in January of not this year, but the year before, I had a procedure done for exactly the same problems that you're talking about. I had fibroid cysts and a polyp, and I'm not sure if they used the same tool, but because they showed me what they took out of me afterward, and it was in a little jar, and it didn't appear to be chopped up, but it was definitely, they scraped a good portion of inside my uterus.
Yeah.
And since then I haven't had a period, or I guess it pretty much forced menopause to happen, and I'm currently 49 years old. So I'm just wondering if I should be concerned if it was the same tool. I heard a commercial about what you guys are talking about, and I actually called the office probably about 8 months ago and asked them if they used the tool that has been recalled, and they wouldn't tell me the tool they used on me. They just said that, no, it wasn't the same tool, which I thought was kind of odd.
And I don't believe the tool's been recalled, has it, Doctor?
The Johnson & Johnson tool has been recalled.
That has been.
That was the most commonly used version of it. It's called the Gynecare Morcellator. Now, you know, look, I have to make a distinction. There's two ways they could do it. I mean, what you described to me, what your caller just described to us is, it was a polyp on the inside of the uterus, and those, you know, that's a sort of a different operation when they go into the uterine cavity and they sort of suck out polyps. That's a different operation than when they actually go into the abdominal cavity and mince up the entire sort of to get it out. So those are two different operations. So it's possible that your caller had a hysteroscopic morcellation, which is a somewhat different and less risky operation with respect to cancer upstaging.
And
so
I'd also like to comment as to she had said that she had called the office and asked for that information. That information legally belongs to her. And she absolutely has the right to know every instrument that was used on her during any surgery, and should be offered that in writing by her physician. And you know, that's you know, that is completely within her purview to ask that. And you know, a lot of this has to do with transparency and people not realizing the power that they have. But I would actually, you know, encourage her to call back and say, please, I'd like a report of the instrument that was used in my care. Because, like I said, that information belongs to her.
Well, and the physician, if he's worth anything, will willingly do that, won't he? Or she?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's go to Tom in Lake Forest, California. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, George. And
sure thing.
Good evening, doctors. I've been in quality assurance for medical device manufacturers of implantable devices and tools for about 35 years. And I wanted to make a point about your statement regarding the FDA actions and medical device companies. And my point I wanted to make was that device companies are required under CFR 820 to do safety testing for the intended use of the device, and they keep careful records for that. And I think the doctors are correct in that this particular use of the device for potentially cancerous tissue in the body is certainly should be what we call contraindicated. And that maybe that's a good point, but I don't think the device companies are being irresponsible if they are not aware of this and don't label against it.
I would agree with that, if they're not aware of it.
Well, so you know, I'll make one comment. So with respect to safety testing, I mean, the idea here is that the 510K regulatory regime goes on the concept of substantial equivalence to a predicate. So in other words, a device has to be demonstrated to be similar to a prior device. Now, the concept of safety testing, as we do it in the drug sector, has to do with doing clinical trials and looking at outcomes in patients who are undergoing a clinical trial. No such thing really happens for 510K devices, which are the vast majority, over 80% of devices in this country, go through the 510K device. So in other words, if a device goes out into the marketplace and it causes cancer to be upstaged, there's really no way to pick that up as an unknown, because there's no clinical testing being done. There's no clinical testing in the same sense that is done for drugs. Now, that's acceptable in the sense that there are far more devices coming out because the speed of technology is much more rapid than the speed of drug development. However, the issue here is that on the market end of things, the FDA is not requiring the vast majority of devices to go through active windows of post-market surveillance, so in other words, surveying outcomes, and the self-reporting mandates are not being strictly enforced. I mean, really up until recently, the FDA has done a very poor job of either prosecuting or penalizing drug companies and hospitals for failure to self-report.
Specifically our case, we were the first report, when we reported my complication, if you will, to the FDA, even though this device had been on the market for 20 years,
wow.
This was the first report to the FDA of any problem of this nature, even though the company, Johnson & Johnson, had received notification from a pathologist, actually, saying exactly what we're saying, that this is spreading cancer. They didn't report it. None of the hospitals reported it. My hospital didn't report it.
So, George, I just want to highlight this fact is that with respect to the morcellator, the first report after 20 years of this adverse outcome, which, by the way, was sprinkled throughout the literature, so anyone with, any degree of mindfulness looking at the literature on PubMed, which is the medical, the government.
It's like the Bible, isn't it?
It's the database for all medical information. This information was out there, but neither the FDA nor the manufacturer had bothered to actually look at this. And really, the first time the FDA heard about this is when I filed the report with them, and I called the associate commissioner of the FDA. So the notion of that your caller basically suggests here that these device manufacturers are doing the right thing or following the letter of the law, they are following the letter of the law. The issue here is that the law is not sufficient, and the FDA is not. The Center for Devices and Radiologic Health at the FDA is not geared towards patient safety. They're geared towards efficiently getting devices onto the marketplace, And those are two very different missions. One is a marketing mission, one is a patient safety mission. And, last I checked, the federal government should not be in the business of marketing.
That's right. Well, you two keep doing what you're doing. Don't give up. You haven't given up yet. So keep pushing, okay? All right, thank you for being on the program. Their website's, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Truly a remarkably incredible story. Who would think that a medical device could potentially be spreading cancer, doing exactly what it wanted to do, and that was to eradicate cancer? Unbelievable. Up next, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe with some great stories. We'll be back.